Hello and welcome to this New Hampshire primary reaction edition of the 538 Politics podcast. I'm Galen Druk, and we actually have results for you guys tonight. The networks have called the race for Bernie Sanders, and as of recording this podcast, it looks like Bernie Sanders has 26%, Buttigieg has 24%, Klobuchar has 20%, then there's a significant drop-off with Warren coming in at 9% and Biden coming in at 8%. So let's talk about those results, what caused those results, and also what they mean going forward. Here with me to do that, our editor-in-chief, Nate Silver. How's it going?
Going great. I'm happy that we're actually here at midnight and not at 3 a.m.
Me too. And also here with us is senior politics writer, Claire Malone. How are you?
I'm good, Galen.
Coming back from the Buttigieg rally, how was that?
You know, after a couple of hundred people stew in a gym for 4 hours, it takes on a certain smell, but it was good.
See, the kind of analysis that you don't get from watching TV.
That's right.
Also here with us is elections analyst Jeffrey Skelly. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing great. We've got some results. We can talk about something.
Yeah, we actually have data this time. Jeff, I know that you've been looking into the exit polls all night, looking at the crosstabs and just trends across the state. So describe the picture for us. Where did Klobuchar get her support from? Where did Buttigieg get his support from? And then ultimately, what brought Sanders across the finish line?
Well, there are a number of things to go into. I mean, I think, you know, one of the stories of the night is the Klobuchar, if we're using
which
that.
Which doesn't make grammatical sense, but...
it's
Klobuchar, Klobuchar, pick your poison.
Yeah.
Wait, why doesn't it make grammatical sense?
It's just, it's...
Her name
never
is Klobuchar.
All right, go ahead, Jeffrey.
Well, obviously that was sort of, I would say, the surprise of the night, or maybe it wasn't that surprising given the trend we saw in her poll numbers, but obviously she outperformed her polls much more than anyone else did. So for one thing, she did very well among moderates. She actually won among college-educated voters, including college-educated women, which might help explain why Elizabeth Warren didn't do so well. Mm-hmm. So those are some examples. Buttigieg also did very well against among moderate voters. Also, like high-income voters, and among late deciders, Klobuchar actually did very well. So, and people who said the debate mattered, which maybe says something that for once a debate really mattered.
I know. Hey. Micah was saying on the post-debate podcast that debates don't matter. So we'll have to get back in touch with him when we're back in New York. But one final thing to the point about Sanders. Where was his support coming from? Obviously, the stereotype is younger voters and more progressive voters. Does that hold up?
Yes, he definitely won among young voters, whereas Klobuchar won among old voters. But among people who were locked in before the last few days, Sanders did very well. He won among those voters, won among very liberal voters. They were all in on him pretty much. And so that's how he ends up with this narrow plurality in the end.
If you know you're for Sanders, then you're sticking with Sanders. So, Claire, you were at the Buttigieg rally covering his, I guess it seemed like somewhat of a victorious speech, even if he came in second. What were people talking about at the rally? What was the mood?
Well, I think of these things, it's always split between what the voters are talking about, what the people in the press risers are talking about. And voters are certainly, you know, I kind of made a point to ask Buttigieg supporters in New Hampshire, a very white state, and the crowd tonight was very white. How do you see his path forward after this state, right? Does he have any sort of viability? And so, you know, there's a discussion there of if he's a winner, as he's sort of proving tonight, you know, he can win in other states. I think the press corps was pretty interested in keeping a close eye on how close the Buttigieg-Sanders margin was. And in the end, I think it's going to be very, very close.
Perhaps under 2 points.
Exactly. And so that was kind of the mood in the room, was just a curiosity about how close it was actually going to be. I think you saw Sanders and Buttigieg playing a little chicken with cable TV airtime, trying to see who could get, you know, their speech on the air at the, you know, last and have the final word about the whole night. But I would say that Buttigieg gave a speech that was certainly victorious. I think he was actually, you know, he's kind of a reserved candidate, kind of a reserved person. And I think he was actually maybe not full on AB Klobucharing, but certainly joyful. His mother was there, which is kind of a rare sighting. So it was certainly what they wanted to see out of New Hampshire, that close margin.
Nate, we were talking earlier in the evening when on cable TV, a lot of the commentary was about Klobuchar and Buttigieg. And you were like, hey, people aren't paying enough attention to Bernie Sanders. So let's talk about Bernie Sanders. What did you make of his performance tonight?
So, I mean, the issue is there are like two versions of this, right? There's a version where everyone's totally rational and we're starting out with tabula rasa. And then there's the kind of corrective version. But let me start with the corrective version because that was how you led me to this question, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just on a fundamental level, it did seem weird to me that a lot more was being made about Amy Klobuchar's third place finish than Pete Buttigieg's second place finish. And in turn, more was made about Buttigieg being in second than Sanders in first. Because you can obviously start to dissect that a little bit more. You can say, for example, that this should have been a really good state for Bernie Sanders. I agree. He dropped off a lot from 2016. I agree, although a multi-candidate race and a two-candidate race are a little bit hard to compare, right?
Yeah, he got 60%.
He's not closing well with late deciders. I agree. I agree with all this. You know, he hasn't proven he can turn out new voters. I agree with all of this. But the fact is also that, like, New Hampshire is also a really good state for Pete Buttigieg. And it's probably a pretty good state for Amy Klobuchar. Why? Because this state has a lot of white people. In fact, a lot of college-educated white people who are highly up-to-date on politics, follow a lot of news. That's kind of their core constituency. So, to me, nobody has won a state outside of kind of their comfort zone. However, Bernie has finished first in one of these states and kind of tied for first. We don't actually know the delegate winner of Iowa yet. By the way, the delegates are a tie in New Hampshire tonight, right? But, like, you know, and Bernie is the, by all indications, the candidate who has, I suppose, the best chance of doing well in other states. We haven't had polls of Nevada and South Carolina in a very long time. We do know that Sanders is probably leading in national polls. We do know that his coalition is actually fairly diverse. It's diverse racially. It's not diverse age-wise, which is interesting, right? But he has, like, a lot of support of all races of voters under 40 or 45 or so. We know he has a lot of money. If you've kind of won 1.5 states and you're in the lead in national polls and you've raised the most money of any non-billionaire.
But in some ways, I think the reason why I take your point, Nate, like, people should be paying attention to the Sanders win. But I also think this state was kind of about who lost and who was the surprise. So Klobuchar was a surprise. But I think Biden and Warren were, you know, the fact that they didn't meet the delegate threshold was, I think, pretty surprising to people. And I think that Klobuchar got the bump in attention in part because of the Warren really poor showing
here. Yeah, so you need 15%, of course, to get delegates, and Warren got 9, Biden got 8 as of time of this recording. What on earth happened? I mean, Biden, we obviously saw his poor performance in Iowa, and I think people were almost already writing the script for tonight. He went to South Carolina for tonight's results instead of actually staying in New Hampshire. Biden did. But what happened with Warren? Do you have a sense of where the campaign is at, Claire?
I think the argument that people are using about Warren on two fronts about her electability is really catching on with voters. These are the two things you hear from voters. Should we really nominate a woman this time around? And if you're a Klobuchar voter and you do think you should nominate a woman, you're kind of freaked out by her progressivism. And I think that Warren's progressivism, and I think those attacks have been really effective on her campaign in the past couple of weeks. I think I said this earlier last week. They kind of were late to get into the post-Iowa narrative scrapping. And I think that kind of maybe hurt them a little bit here. So it's kind of an interesting on the margins sort of thing.
Yeah. Jeff, did you see anything else about Biden and Warren's performance in the polls that paint us a picture of what went wrong?
Well, I mean, I mentioned it earlier, but if you look at college-educated voters, which, you know, up until, you know, late in 2019, looked like a really good area for Elizabeth Warren in terms of support. And tonight, I mean, she ended up losing, didn't do very well among them, and Klobuchar ended up winning among college-educated voters and college-educated women. If you're trying to figure out how Warren could win, she needed those types of voters, and she didn't really get them nearly at the levels that I think we expected. And maybe some of that was people moving because of electability concerns, like Claire said. But, I mean, if you look at the numbers, that's just it's a clear weakness for her.
I mean, if you're in New Hampshire, people are super attuned to news coverage and super attuned to the polls. And, like, Warren, fairly or not, did not get favorable coverage out of Iowa, even though she beat her polls, finished in third place. I don't think she performed particularly well at the debate. Maybe more importantly, voters in our poll with Ipsos gave her, she usually gets really good numbers. She got mediocre numbers for this debate. You know, it's like kind of a math problem, right? If you have three candidates who are ascending, where Sanders and Buttigieg co-won Iowa, Also, they both did well in the debate, according to our poll. Klobuchar, fifth place in Iowa, somehow got momentum from that because of a good performance in the debate. But if you have three candidates who are taking votes from other candidates, there's like only so many votes to go around. By the way, some of the minor candidates, you know, none of the Gabbards and the Yangs who dropped out and the Patricks and the Bennetts, right? Most of them actually slightly underperformed their polls too. And so it really was a question of like, okay, here are three horses that are moving forward and you're going to pick one of them. Two of them happen to be ones that overlap a lot, but there are different wrinkles here. You know, Warren does well among college-educated voters. If you're, though, someone who says, I want a experienced woman senator, or just an experienced senator, period, who's kind of within the broad mainstream of the Democratic Party, then Warren and Klobuchar work pretty well, right? If you're highly checking a list of moderate versus liberal positions on a bunch of issues, then maybe not. But like, that's not how a lot of voters think. And so, for both Buttigieg and Klobuchar, so long names, right? Can you imagine if they become like VP and president? That
not going to happen.
You can't even abbreviate Buttigieg too. That creates problems.
Okay, wait, but I want to say we gotta.
You could do Klo, but like the analogous.
You could do booty.
It's problematic.
So I had somebody suggest in either an email or on Twitter today that we should be describing undecided voters at Buttigieg rallies as booty curious. I don't know if that's appropriate for the podcast, but it's going to stay because it's late and this podcast isn't going to get very edited anyway. But you mentioned Yang and Bennett, so we should pour one out for both of those. We're going to talk about how this affects the model and what this means for the next two contests in the nation, which are much more diverse. But first, today's podcast is brought to you by Ring. Ring's mission is to make neighborhoods safer. You might already know about their smart video doorbells and cameras that protect millions of people everywhere. Ring helps you stay connected to your home anywhere in the world. So if there's a package delivery or surprise visitor, you'll get an alert and you'll be able to see, hear, and speak to them all from your phone. Ring has a special offer for 538 listeners on a Ring welcome kit available now at ring.com/538. The kit includes a video doorbell and a Chime Pro, which is just what you need to start building a ring of security around your home today. Go to ring.com/538 for that Ring welcome kit. Again, that's ring.com/538. Today's podcast is also brought to you by Upstart. Getting into debt is easy. Getting out of it is hard, especially if your credit score isn't great. Thankfully, there's Upstart.com, the revolutionary lending platform that knows you're more than just your credit score and offers smarter interest rates to help you pay off high interest credit card debt. Upstart goes beyond the traditional score when assessing your credit worthiness. They actually reward you based on your education and job history in the form of a smarter interest rate. Upstart believes you're more than just your credit score. The best part, once the loan is approved and accepted, most people get their funds the very next business day. Over 400,000 people have used Upstart to pay off credit cards or meet their financial goals. See why Upstart is ranked number one in their category with over 300 businesses on Trustpilot, and hurry to upstart.com/politics to find out how low your Upstart rate is. Checking your rate only takes a few minutes. Again, that's upstart.com/politics. All right, we're back. Claire, you mentioned that at the Buttigieg rally, you were probing some of the voters about their thoughts on his path forward, given that the states get a lot more diverse. It's no longer either Buttigieg or Klobuchar's strong suit post-New Hampshire. Did you get satisfactory results? Or looking at his strategy in Nevada or South Carolina, do you see any clear kind of foundation for something bigger?
Well, I don't know if you can ever get satisfying analysis from people who are heavily in the tank for a candidate.
Amen.
But I do think, you know, frankly, like a lot of what voters there are saying is mimicry of the campaign line, which is sort of a variation on a Trump 2016 line, which is basically winning begets winning. So win, and then other people will vote for you because they want to vote for a winner and make their vote count. Now, there's some holes in that logic, I think, because I do think, you know, the Buttigieg campaign will say no one knew his name a year ago. He's still being introduced to new audiences, all of which is true, particularly minority audiences. But he had a really late start going down into places like South Carolina, going into Nevada. And I think someone like Sanders and frankly Warren, who has a pretty good operation down there, I think a lot of, you know, black women voters might have some sense of camaraderie with her, want to vote for a woman still. You know, you could see more inroads for other candidates who are still in the game rather than Buttigieg, who I do think is a bit late in relationship building down there, in part because he focused so much of his effort on winning these first two states. So it's kind of, you know, it's this double-edged sword of you got to prove you can win, but then...
By winning the early states, but then also already have the campaign structure in place to carry it through.
Yeah, so it's, you know, I was talking with another reporter and he was kind of saying, you know, well, what if Biden drops out in the next couple weeks? Then, like, maybe Biden voters would be, I don't know, I want to vote strategically. I want another moderate white guy who could, you know, possibly win over moderate white guys in the upper Midwest. So people, I think, are really, I think the overall sense was kind of, I don't know.
Yeah.
What's going to happen?
I mean, Nate and Jeff, does winning beget winning? Is that borne out in the data? Is that a logical argument?
Winning relative... You want to get the more technical answer, right?
Oh, no. Winning relative to losing begets winning. Winning is that what it is?
Is good.
Give it the layman's term.
Winning is good. But winning is interpreted relative to expectations. That's one reason why that Sanders didn't get that much credit. I thought it was especially a lack of credit, but like leave that aside for now. If you're expected to win states because they you're the national frontrunner in national polls and or it's a good state for you geographically or whatever, then you don't get as much credit for a win there, right? But still, you know, winning does to some extent beget winning. And at the end of the day, the headlines will read Bernie Sanders wins New Hampshire, the literal headlines, right? The cable news analysis will be so much more complicated. And the New York Times news analysis will be, you know, more complicated. But the headlines do matter to some degree, and it's a good headline for Sanders. But yeah, look, I mean, the thing that went wrong for Bernie is that he only got 25.8% of the vote and almost lost. And those are big problems, actually. Everything else, though, went well for Bernie, including the exact order of finish of the rest of the field. Because the two biggest threats to Bernie were always Elizabeth Warren, who could win the progressive lane, and Joe Biden, who until 8 days ago was a national frontrunner. And now you not only have not had one of the moderates win, you actually had a new moderate, Amy Klobuchar, enter the arena. And actually now there are four moderates, Klobuchar, Buttigieg, Bloomberg, and our friend Joe Biden, who all have some type of claim on being the strongest moderate candidate. They all can make some type of claim about that, right? Klobuchar can say, I have the most momentum, of course, a very vague concept. Buttigieg can say, I've done the best so far, which is definitely true. Biden can say, I'm still the strongest in national polls and have the most diverse coalition, also definitely true. And Bloomberg could say, I am the one who has a ton of money, and the fact that you've all underperformed means that you might as well turn to me to coordinate around. So they can all make a kind of credible claim, and like, I don't really know if it's going to get resolved before Super Tuesday. So you get a lot of outcomes that proceed like this. Who the hell knows what happens in Nevada? Maybe Biden comes back in South Carolina, maybe not, right? But you have Bernie Sanders getting a strong plurality of delegates on Super Tuesday. One of the moderates emerges as the strongest candidate, and then that moderate is coming from behind with only about 60% of delegates still to allocate, with Bernie Sanders having a lead, with maybe a majority unlikely, if not unattainable, right? So, I mean, the kind of modal outcome, we'll see what our model says when it's done running. The modal outcome at this point is like, maybe you have a Bernie Sanders plurality and you have a moderate vote.
That's really spinning it out, though. I mean, all the way.
Yeah. I'm curious, though. The theory was always that Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders were in some way sharing voters. What we saw tonight was that Elizabeth Warren dropped off significantly in the polls, and that Bernie Sanders didn't overperform his polls, didn't pick up much support, and ultimately, you know, you can't compare 2016 to 2020, but like wasn't performing as well in places where he did perform quite well in 2016. Why isn't he picking up Elizabeth Warren voters? Was that theory wrong all along?
I don't know if he necessarily didn't pick up any. I mean, I know if we're looking at the polls, maybe the very liberal Warren supporters are the ones that stuck with her, and then ones who weren't very liberal, maybe their second choice, the very liberal ones, is Sanders. And maybe ones who weren't very liberal said, Warren doesn't seem to be doing so hot, and moved to Klobuchar, for example. I mean, that may have been what we saw, especially, again, looking at like college education. I mean, just that stat just continues to surprise the heck out of me. I mean, it's given Warren's strength there and not too long ago. So I do think it's partially ideology, and so you would think Sanders, but we've seen discussions of class and education, how that overlaps, and how, I mean, Sanders, for example, won among non-college educated voters in New Hampshire. And so I think you might see a situation where college educated voters who are liberal looking at other options besides Sanders. And I think that's what we may have seen in part tonight.
Nate, you kind of hinted at, you know, what the model will say when this is all said and done. And once it's finished updating, which I think it will finish soon, and then we'll be posting updates. Can you give us maybe a little guess? Does it seem like...
I'm not going to guess. There's a lot, including candidates dropping out tonight. There are quite a few contingencies. And look, in some ways, I don't think this is the time when you should be paying that much attention to the model for two reasons. Number one is that this might be another case where the spin that voters hear is different than the model assumptions, right? Where the model assumes that looks a little bit at margin of victory, but Bernie Sanders gets quite a bit of credit for winning New Hampshire, which may or may not be how the more sophisticated / spin forward analysis actually works, right? Number two is that you have this big coordination problem where, okay, let me draw up a hypothetical. Let's say that the Culinary Union in Nevada endorses Amy Klobuchar in the Nevada caucuses. Let's say that 10 or 15 prominent Democratic lawmakers, maybe not necessarily senators and governors, but like representatives, right, endorse Klobuchar, some of whom are switches from other candidates, right? Let's say that she surges from 4% to 10% in national polls, which begets a further surge based on favorable news coverage, right? And the next week and a half are all about Amy Klobuchar, and then she finishes a strong second to Bernie Sanders in the Iowa caucuses, right?
Like in the Iowa caucuses?
In the Nevada caucuses.
It's late for
the model cannot think about scenarios that are that specific, right? That's a speculation. It kind of averages out like a lot of different plausibilities, but how this result is interpreted and whether there is any effort to coordinate around one of the moderates
is hard
and
to
who drops out are all pretty hard to predict.
Okay, speaking of the dropping out part, maybe we can wrap things up on, is this too suggestive? I guess, whatever. Let's talk about Biden. At what point does it become clear, Claire, that things aren't working out, that there's not a viable path forward? When is the earliest that he drops out?
You know, I'm still of the, let's see how he does in Nevada and South Carolina, although I will say he's going much more all in on South Carolina and the South in general. I think so. The order of operations is Nevada, then South Carolina. If he doesn't do well, I think the earliest he'll drop out would be South Carolina, because he really has put so much at stake in that particular state as an example of what's to come on Super Tuesday, basically, or the big voting swath dates in March and some in April. He's not going to drop out before then, I don't think. But I do think his campaign, I mean, it was a radical move, I think, though understandable, for him to leave for South Carolina. I think on a human level, he's probably pretty humiliated right now. And I think you can see him kind of expressing that frustration on the trail. So I think it's a campaign that's doing a lot of aggressive soul searching right now, but I don't think he'll drop out right away.
Yeah. Jeff, you were making an argument earlier this evening. Your hot take was that Biden could be the next to drop out or something.
I don't know if I put it quite like that, but basically what I was saying was it would not shock me if maybe this coming weekend Biden seemingly out of nowhere announces he's dropping out ahead of Nevada. I think what his campaign is going to do is they are going to look at their numbers in Nevada, and let's say he's like just cratered, you know, which is possible. I mean, given the start here, and maybe his fundraising is drying up, and maybe he's starting to get calls from Democrats who are saying, Joe, if you stay in this race, you're going to make it more likely that Bernie Sanders is going to be the nominee. And I know that you're a Democrat, a capital D Democrat, and this is what you care about. You like want to beat Trump, and it doesn't look like it's going to be you. But now he might counter and say, well, this is my last hurrah, you know, or something, but my last ride. But I just wanted to put it out there to people, like, it would be surprising, but you maybe shouldn't be shocked if it happens. Because at the same time, for Joe Biden, if this is it, he's already been humiliated. And if it looks like he's going to get even more humiliated, that might be enough for him to say, yeah, you know what, I'm going to get out, and then endorses Klobuchar or something, which then, you know, is a spin on the race and might change things.
Yeah. Nate, do you want the final word on Biden's next moves?
Statistically, people drop out when they're dropping, right? They drop out when they're falling in the polls, and Biden is...
Hashtag analysis.
Yeah. And he's falling in the polls. At the same time, like, I don't know. He actually is still second in national polls, first in some polls. You have two states that you didn't figure would be very good for him. Yeah, he's underperformed relative to that, right? I mean, I don't know. You'd think he'd want to see it through until South Carolina. I would think that the thing that might preempt something is, like, you know, maybe just not feeling it, right? Maybe he has poor polls in South Carolina. I think he could. I think if he were convinced that he could have a 50-50 shot or even a respectable shot of winning South Carolina, then I don't think he'd quit. I think even if Nevada, because expectations can't really get any lower, you know what I mean? And it might even be, I mean, no one knows what the f*** is going on. Now you're going to have to edit it. Sorry, guys. No one knows what the hell is going on in Nevada anyway, because no one ever knows what's going on in the Nevada caucus. It would seem like it's good for Bernie, but the Culinary Union today just sent out these flyers that said, Bernie is going to take away your health care in not quite so many words, right? That's interesting, you know.
Harry Reid. Love a wild card.
Harry Reid.
No, I mean, like...
Chaos in Nevada.
I mean, who has... Someone has to win.
Isn't that like the state's motto, though?
Chaos in Nevada. What if what happens in Nevada stays in Nevada? And then South Carolina, I mean, right now, actually, we have no idea where it now. Right, the model thinks that right now, actually, I'm going to take that all back. The model is confused because it's pricing in further declines from Biden in a cascading way from New Hampshire, which makes Nevada worse, and then Nevada affects South Carolina, and then all of a sudden you could have Bernie Sanders winning South Carolina, which isn't what you would necessarily expect based
or Danny
on...
Danny Chung or something.
Yeah.
too much Veep.
Yeah.
Okay, actually, let me wrap on this question, which is a little bit backwards looking, but we got a lot of questions about it after the Iowa caucuses and then never talked too much about it. So this is to you, Jeff, and then we'll wrap for the evening. Turnout. How was turnout in 2020 compared to past primaries in New Hampshire? And is there anything we can deduce from that?
Well, it's interesting because at the start of the night when I was looking at places that had completely reported, turnout looked like it was behind 2008 and just a slight bit ahead of 2016. So just in the Democratic primaries. And 2008 was the record. I was just shy of 290,000. And obviously that was an extremely competitive primary with Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. Also John Edwards, who hadn't completely fallen, left the race yet at that point. But as things stand, it looks like it might be around the same, or even higher maybe.
Than 2008.
Close. Yeah, yeah. Now, I think one important thing here to remember, though, is that in 2008, the Republicans also had a competitive primary going on. So if you're thinking about where unaffiliated voters were going, they were probably split. I mean, I don't know how they split, but to some extent, there were a lot of unaffiliated voters showing up in both primaries. Well, with an uncompetitive Republican primary this time around, you're going to figure that if unaffiliated voters voted in a primary, most of them were voting in the Democratic one. And you could actually even see that show up in the exit poll numbers for the Republican primary, which, oh, by the way, President Trump won very easily. I think he was at 86% the last time I checked.
Solid 10% for Bill Weld, though.
Yes, exactly.
Tony Chow and I saw him in the lobby yesterday.
But the numbers in terms of like ideology among Republicans was like the most conservative primary electorate that they'd ever – like. The exit polls have ever had in New Hampshire. And I think that's suggestive of if they're unaffiliated to lean Republican, they either didn't vote in the Republican primary and just stayed home, or they even voted in the Democratic primary.
Mm-hmm. And that also showed up, though, in the Democratic primary exit polls, right? Because you saw moderates have higher numbers, right?
Yeah, it was actually a slightly more moderate electorate, primary electorate per the exit polls than in 2016. And I think that's – there were some – unaffiliated who might have voted in the Republican primary last time, maybe for John Kasich or something, and this time they're voting in the Democratic primary, and maybe that helped Klobuchar, for example.
No, we saw some bad takes on cable TV about how, the electorate is getting more moderate, and it's like, well, those are actually different voters, so important to keep in mind. Anyway, I am sure that we'll be podcasting again before too long. It's also nearing 1 a.m., so thank you, Nate.
Thank you, Galen.
What's that? Thank you, Claire.
Thanks, Galen.
And thank you, Jeff.
Thank you, Galen.
My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow, Anna Rothschild, and Kevin Ryder are on audio and video this evening, which reminds me, you can watch this on YouTube if you'd like. We're sitting over in some empty corner. All of the news organizations are wrapping up, packing things in, and we're just hanging out. You know,
check out our makeup tutorials at 530.com/YouTube.
You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.